I think food and sort of food production is a real leveler. We all have to eat. And so getting an insight into what people were eating, we're not just focusing on the people who have gold bracelets associated with them or, you know, buried in special places. We can understand what everyone was kind of doing and what they were doing in order to stay healthy or to survive.
Can you first introduce yourself?
I'm Amy Styring. I'm Associate Professor of Archaeological Science at the University of Oxford.
And you're an archaeologist and also a chemist?
So I studied archaeology and chemistry, and then I've managed to carry on basically using chemistry as a tool to understand more about life in the past. So it's a little bit like, well, archaeology is a bit like detective work, trying to work out what people were doing from the traces that they left behind. And chemistry is a tool that can help with that. So using the actual molecules or the chemistry of the things that people left behind to understand more about their lives.
Welcome to the Nature Season of Feed, a food systems podcast presented by Table. I'm Matthew Kessler. In our next two episodes, we're going to hear two different answers to the question, what's a natural diet?
The topic I'm interested in is what people were eating and then also how they were producing their food. So how they were growing their crops, how they were herding their animals, and then what impacts that those activities had on their environment.
With Amy Styring, Professor of Archaeological Science at the University of Oxford, we look for answers 6,000 years ago.
One of the things that this series is looking at is ideas around naturalness and what's a natural diet. And there's a lot of claims about how different diets in the past are seen as a benchmark for how we should eat today. Do you have some views on this?
Yeah, so I've been asked that question before. My answer is always, well, yeah, how far back do you want to go? I mean, how far back is natural? We can talk about, you know, our really ancient ancestors, sort of evolutionary timescales. We actually don't know that much about what they were eating. I mean, it's very difficult to find out from their remains. We've been eating dairy products, you know, maybe not just as milk, but as fermented milk, yogurt, cheese, since we've started farming, which is up to 10,000 years ago. But is that sort of far back enough? I think there's been a bit of a focus on meat eating, for example. It's easier to understand what types of animals people are eating because we find their bones, whereas we don't necessarily get to, or it's not so easy to find out, you know, different types of plants that they were eating.
Animal bones are bigger, and they preserve more easily than plant material, which decomposes much faster and often doesn't show up in the fossil record. So how might the way different food decomposes impact our understanding of past diets?
There's definitely been a bias towards meat consumption because it's easier for us to see. So we find the bones of animals on archaeological digs, and so we can identify which species those animals were. We can try and get an idea of how many animals and, you know, how important they might be in the diet. But actually, it's really difficult to recover the plant remains. Either they just don't preserve as well, sort of leafy plants will only survive thousands of years in really specific conditions, if it's very dry or if it's very wet. So we don't necessarily have those visible remains that we do for animal bones. But even then, they're just a lot harder to find. They're a lot smaller. So you have to sieve the soil in order to find those small plant remains, which hasn't necessarily been done on very old excavations, for example.
Amy Styring is part of a group of archaeologists that apply chemistry techniques to older excavations as a way to learn something new about our past. Amy believes that the insights from this new research can reshape, or at least nuance, our understanding of past human diets.
The newer methods, the chemistry that's been used to understand what people were actually eating, this, again, is sort of biased. We look at the collagen, which is the protein in bones, but this is biased towards, it's produced from the protein in the diet, and meat and fish contain much more protein than most plants do. And I think it's only recently that really exciting methods, which can actually look for specific molecules, which are specific to certain types of plants, even maybe species of plants, seeing that actually it's not just about those main staples like meat, carbohydrate, fat, but actually what plants did they exploit, and the sort of the vitamins, the minerals, the sort of wider antioxidants that come from a diverse range of plants.
Of course, these main staples, these high energy foods, are important. But what else were people eating, and how important were those foods in their diets? Understanding this picture leads Amy to offer a pretty clear answer on what constitutes a natural diet and how that might guide what we should eat today.
I think there's a lot more to be done to understand what people ate in the past at different points, which is really relevant. But I think what really strikes me is actually the diversity of different things that people ate in the past. So even just talking about cereals, today we rely very heavily on bread wheat and a particular kind of very narrow sort of gene bank of that bread wheat. Well, actually, we're learning more and more that in the past, people weren't just growing one type of wheat. They were growing a mixture of different types of wheats, and even within different species, you know, different land races, which are kind of different variations on those species. And I think that we've become quite niched. So I think that's, if I were to try and pick a sort of what is a natural diet, I think it's diversity. Even when people started farming, they didn't stop hunting animals for a very long period. They didn't stop collecting the wild fruits and nuts and plants that they had before they were growing crops. So I think it's that sort of diversity in the diet that maybe has more of a nod towards naturalness, whatever time point we want to put on that.
Amy Styring examines what we ate in the past, specifically around moments of transition in human history, like the shift from hunter-gatherer to farming societies, and how our diets and food production changed when we moved into cities.
So I want to focus in on this transition from hunter-gatherer to sedentary farming. So can you first set the scene? Where are we and when are we?
So I'm going to focus on, yes, as you say, this transition from hunting and gathering to farming, but focusing on Northwest Europe. So particularly Britain and sort of southern, well, Scandinavia. So this is because a lot of work, a lot of the kind of archaeological science work has been done here for the last few decades. Yeah, so here farming actually started relatively late. So we're talking about 4,000 BC, so that's about 6,000 years ago.
And I'm really excited to talk to you because, like you said, there's been decades of research, but there's also new research, which you've been a part of too, that sort of challenges some of our previous findings. So first, what has been our understanding of what diets were like during this time?
The traditional way of trying to find out what people were eating was looking at basically the rubbish that they left behind. So animal bones that they threw away after preparing the food, eating the food, the plant remains, hopefully, that you might get because they sort of fell close to the fire and they got toasted. And so you find them as kind of these little charred remains. Fish bones, but again, these are really small. They break up very easily, so they're a bit more difficult to find. What was kind of 30, 40 years ago now was revolution, was actually we could look at the chemistry of the bones of the people themselves to actually find out, okay, well, what were their tissues made of? So has to come from their diet. And actually using the chemistry, so looking at different versions of carbon, for example, they're called isotopes. And these are found in different proportions in different types of foods. So particularly useful for distinguishing between marine resources, so fish, for example, seals, and terrestrial, so yeah, herbivores and also plants that have grown on the land.
Okay, so three or four decades back, archaeologists began not only to look at the animal bones and plant remains to determine what we ate, but they started taking samples from the bones of humans and analyzing what their tissues were made of. This method helped us better break down what animals and plants were people eating from the sea and from the land.
And so quite early work was done measuring these different isotopes of carbon, different versions of carbon in these human bones. So from Mesolithic context, which is the hunter-gatherers before farming, and then also from the first farmers, what's called the Neolithic. And they found, really surprisingly, that whereas there's evidence that the hunter-gatherers are eating a lot of fish, once you see other evidence that people were farming. So we get pottery, we get domestic animals like sheep, goats, cows, and we get cereals like wheat and barley. They were no longer eating fish, or at least you couldn't detect it by looking at these carbon isotopes. And so there's this big discussion of, oh, people turned away from the sea as soon as they sort of were able to produce their own food. They stopped fishing and they sort of focused on the land. This was really controversial. And so it's kind of almost stimulated an ongoing impetus to sort of to almost challenge that idea and to work out whether this is actually the case. I think that's a lot of what these new methods are doing is almost trying to add nuance to the overarching picture.
So 6,000 years ago in Northwest Europe, hunter-gatherers gradually began living more stationary lives, and they changed their diets. Previously, they were gathering more seeds, berries, and nuts, hunting land animals, and fishing. And as they started to move towards farming, they were eating more domesticated animals and crops. And they largely stopped eating fish, which is something we're still learning about. But did they still hunt land animals?
Not necessarily abandoning the hunting of the terrestrial animals. So we still find a lot of bones of wild animals. So yeah, things like red deer, elk, wild boar on these early farming sites, and lots of gathered nuts, for example. But it's the fact that they seemed, at least in Northwest Europe, they seemed to have stopped fishing, stopped eating huge quantities of fish and seals as they had done in the past.
Now there are some new methods available. So can you paint the scene? Are you still going on an archaeological dig with your equipment? Is everything happening in a lab? How does this kind of new data gathering look like?
Yeah, so new data gathering is actually really exciting because it doesn't necessarily need new excavations. So it's actually, so one of the new methods is actually looking at the fats that get absorbed into pottery vessels. So when people were cooking in their pots, for example, boiling away their stew, then the fats from, for example, the meat would soak into the actual ceramic, the pottery matrix. And then that pot breaks, it kind of ends up in the soil, and then we can still recover the fats after thousands of years. And I think that was so exciting because actually museums, you know, stores, there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of broken bits of pots that, to be honest, people have studied, done lots of interesting studies to understand how their shapes changed, you know, how the forms of those pots changed and how that might tell us about society and different groups of people. But it's kind of this untapped, a new side. So actually people are going back through the archives and, you know, sort of finding these broken bits of pots and being able to find something new about what people were eating. And so what was a new development in this was that they were able to identify the oils from oily fish, so in these pots. And so they were able to explore this transition. So we, in Scandinavia, for example, actually the hunter-gatherers did have pots. And so they're able to look at, extract the fats from the pots of the hunter-gatherers and see that, yes, they were processing lots of fish in these pots, find lots of these oily fats, but that also the Neolithic farmers were as well. So actually that challenged this idea in Scandinavia, at least, that people completely stopped consuming fish. That wasn't the case in Britain. So Britain, and this is why it's kind of adding nuance, you don't see any evidence for these oily fats from fish in the early farming pots. And so it does seem to hold that people stopped eating fish at this time.
Is there a hypothesis why those two regions took different paths?
So Sweden, for example, southern Sweden, for a long time, hunter-gatherers and farmers lived in close proximity. They were contemporaneous. They must have, well, we know they were interacting with one another. Whereas Britain, it seems, at least from genetic evidence, that kind of early farmers came in to Britain. And yeah, we're still trying to understand, but it seems that maybe there was more of a wholesale kind of transition to farming. Whereas in southern Sweden, people were very much, hunting and gatherers and farmers were very much living alongside each other. So maybe there was less of this kind of dichotomy between the fishing and the farming.
So the fish is one component. What else were you able to detect through these new methods?
Well, yeah, as I said, there has been a bias, even with these new methods, there has been a bias towards these sort of protein-rich foods like the fish and like the meat. But what's really exciting is very recently, people, not myself, but other researchers have looked at, they've been able to look at, for example, the proteins in, so the plaque of your teeth becomes mineralized. It becomes what's called calculus. So it's basically, you have so much plaque, it becomes hard like tartar, but it traps molecules. So it traps kind of everything that's been in your mouth. And so this is a new way to actually detect particular proteins that can be linked to certain types of plants. Now, there hasn't been that much work done on it. It's been mainly focused on trying to identify the milk protein, but more and more work is being done on plants. So I'm kind of excited about that. But what came out really recently, so literally a couple of months ago, was a paper, was a study that has actually identified seaweed in people's teeth. So they, again, it's this calculus. So on the teeth, they were able to identify specific molecules that come from seaweed. And this is just, again, it sort of showcases the diversity of people's diet in the past. We don't think, at least in Western Europe, we don't think of seaweed as a kind of staple or even as a sort of condiment, really. Whereas this study shows that in the past, people were eating seaweed. And so it was an extra part of the diet. So I'm really excited about where it's going. I think, you know, we've seen how this picture of what people were eating has changed already with different methods. I hope that's the sort of next stage, is really revealing more about what the diversity of the plants that these people were eating. And again, exploring whether there is more nuance to this idea that once people could grow their own wheat and barley, they narrowed down their dietary spectrum, or maybe they didn't. Maybe that sort of diversity lasted for a really long time.
I guess this brings a question that we introduced at the beginning, which is we have new methods, we have new understandings of this particular transition in time, and I'm sure these methods will be applied across different time periods in different regions, which will, yeah, as you say, nuance our understanding. What does this mean for you about the debates around what is a natural diet today?
I think the more we know about what people were eating in the past and how they were producing their food, the more, I've had someone describe this to me, and I think it's really nice, is that we can expand the library of possibilities. So today we can only see a certain set of possible ways of eating, possible ways of producing food, whereas the past provides this library of, you know, different ways of doing things. And so it's only by refining the tools that we have to read that library, basically, to see that diversity, that we can really explore that. I think the other thing is that, for me, I find studying the past so exciting because I could set up an experiment today, you know, to see the effects of eating a particular diet on people's health or on society, or in particular, what I'm interested in is sort of the effect of farming in a particular way. You know, what does that do to the soil? What does that do to the environment? What does that impact, does that have on people's health? I can set that experiment up, but I won't be able to see the effects of that over hundreds of thousands of years. Whereas actually by going back to the past, we almost have, it's not an experiment, but we can almost observe how sustainable certain farming practices were, what effects they had on the soil, what effects they had on the environment. And I think that's really important to understand, yeah, the effects of different types of diets or of cultivation practices, how they will affect our world, whether you see that as natural or not.
The past is such an interesting thing to look at because there's such a plethora of examples to draw from, and the conditions in the past are not always the same as the conditions today, especially around population size and the environmental challenge that we are confronted with. Is there any sort of flimflam or common myth about the past when people cherry pick different examples from it that you would like to debunk or to speak to from being a archaeologist, chemist who's actually working on the science that's informing people's understanding?
Sounds bad, but maybe I'm not so tapped into what these myths are. That it makes sense because we're so used as academics to always be looking for the nuance and always having to caveat what we say. And so actually being really aware of what these myths are, maybe I take it for granted that they're not true, if that makes sense. Not that they're not true, but they're always more nuanced than maybe it appears. So, I mean, it's just reiterating the point, but I think for me, it's not necessarily a myth, but I think there's focus on meat because it's easy to see in the archaeological record, easier to see. It's not easy, but it's easier to recognize meat consumption as opposed to plants. I think that is a preconception that most people have when they think of paleo. They think of the kind of paleo diet. They sort of think of the red meat and the and not necessarily about the diversity of potential plants that people would have been supplementing, would have been having in their diets hundreds of thousands of years ago, if that's how far you want to go back when talking about a natural diet.
Just to name my two examples. So I've been very immersed in this Meat the Four Futures project that I've been working on. So I've been hearing all these different arguments and people use the past as, you know, as precedents. We've had some guests who have pointed to older societies that have eaten, you know, a largely meat diet, like way more meat than people do on average today, and they were living healthy lives. And then I know also that there are civilizations going on for quite a long time eating, you know, largely or exclusively plant diets. So yeah, I don't know if there's anything to kind of reflect on with these people drawing from these very different examples of the past.
I think it would be, how do we know that? We've got lots of methods and the new methods developing, but actually we're still relatively limited in terms of what we know. So if we go really far back, you know, tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago, we don't have this, the bone art isn't really preserved, it's fossilized. And so actually the insights that we get into the importance of meat from the chemistry is very limited. So really new work is being done to try and get this from tooth enamel. So we do have teeth preserved. Tooth enamel contains the tiniest amount of protein, absolutely tiny, but people are actually managing to analyze this protein now. And so then maybe we will get more advances into sort of how important meat was in the diet. So I think it's where are we getting this information from? And I would suggest that maybe if it's coming from looking at the animal bones that are found on sites, it's very easy to dismiss or to not be aware of, because it's very hard to find the plant component of the diet. And so I think it's really difficult to actually really get a handle on how important meat was versus plants in the past.
Thank you so much for speaking with us, Amy.
Thank you. It's been fun, and I really look forward to hearing how it comes about.
Digging into the diets of our ancestors, you probably can't help but wonder, how were these old eating habits relevant for our modern lives? One thought I had since chatting with Amy was thinking about dietary trends of today, like the paleo diet. I think one of the attractions to the paleo diet is not just what we should eat, but what we shouldn't eat. Things like processed foods and grains. But it's always strange to me to see someone eat some combination of cauliflower rice and organ meat. It's a weird take on a natural diet. There's a modern fascination that goes beyond the paleo diet to avoid processed foods or grains or whole categories of foods like dairy, despite the fact that, as Amy points out, some of which have been part of human diets for anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000 years ago. Conversations with experts like Amy highlight that we're still learning a lot about what we ate in the past, and with new research challenging some of the ideas of what we ate or how much of something we ate, we can learn a little more and maybe be a little more humble about claiming what a natural diet is, especially given the range of what people ate around the world across different cultures and time periods. Next week, we're going to hear a very different take on what informs our understanding of a natural diet. We talked to a meal scientist, Rickard Tellström, on how diets have changed in Sweden over the last 100 years.
And it's still very difficult to find a good horse meat in the shop. They don't have horse meat on the menu. Why not? It's such a good meat.
A big thanks to Amy Styring, professor of archaeological science at the University of Oxford, for speaking with us. We'll link to her work and other research mentioned in this episode on our website, tabledebates.org. Table is a collaboration between the University of Oxford, Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences, Wageningen University in the Netherlands, University of the Andes in Colombia, National Autonomous University of Mexico, and Cornell University in the United States. This episode was edited and produced by Matthew Kessler, with special thanks to Rye Hickman, Tamsin Blackster, and Tara Garnett. Music by Blue Dot Sessions. Talk to you next week.